welcome to this very special bonus episode of the After Movie Diner. In our attempt to be the finest movie-based podcasting service around, we have for you yet another fantastic interview. This is a part two, if you like, to our already jam-packed 100th episode. The gentleman who graces the waxed leatherette booths of this crumbling but atmospheric eating establishment this week is a film director who, for me, defines a certain style of New York filmmaking. When people think New York, their mind may initially leap to Woody Allen or maybe Martin Scorsese, but my guest tonight, along with a small group of other filmmakers, created a wave of genre films through the 80s and early 90s that captured that 42nd Street in its heyday spirit. Nowadays, the New York you'll see on screen will be a CGI-filled tourist attraction with pretty people having meet-cutes or shiny-suited, white-toothed, grinning businessmen rolling around in horrible piles of cash. Or, at its most irritating, it'll be a bunch of dour-faced hipsters slinking around vegan shoe shops in Brooklyn, making not very profound postmodern statements about the nature of despair while sipping an organic, freshly ground $7 latte. Not so the films of our special guest, where social commentary, action, comedy, horror, grit, grime, atmosphere, and most of all fun, all go hand in hand under the neon-drenched, glorious squalor that used to be Times Square. I claim, for example, that he made the last great horror films to be shot in New York. Can you think of any that were made recently? And even when he travelled west and made movies in Los Angeles, he took that wonderful B-movie 42nd Street feeling with him. He has now taken that spirit too into producing and releasing a fantastic catalogue of lost and restored cult gems on DVD and Blu-ray through his Blue Underground company, giving each one the five-star treatment we true lovers of those movies always knew they deserved. I'm very proud, honoured and happy to welcome the director of Maniac, Vigilante, the Maniac Cop series, Relentless, Uncle Sam and others, Mr. William Lustig, into the After Movie Diner. And the interview can be heard after these short announcements.
Are you fighting with your inner self? Can you decide to commit without guilt or fear? Are you endlessly searching, tired of what mainstream has to offer? Searching through an endless supply of movies that seem never-ending, each just like the last, nothing jumping out at you, knowing that committing to a crappy movie can take up to 2 hours of your life that you'll never get back. That's where we can help. We're Jason and Sean, and we're Film Reviews from the Basement. We take in as many genre films as possible, leaving a simple, committed rating, good, bad, or ugly, of many of the films you've probably wondered about. We broadcast worldwide twice monthly at www.wecamefromthebasement.com. There, you can find archived episodes, radio shows, and we don't stop there. We're committed to writing reviews and movie news and interviews with actual movie stars, writers, and directors of movies across multiple genres that you've probably heard of. If you're cool like us or want to be less snooty or less pretentious, come find us at www.wecamefromthebasement.com. This has been a public service announcement. Jason and Sean.
From the folks that bring you the blogs at nerdlunch.net and cavalcadeofawesome.net, it's the Nerd Lunch Podcast. Join CT, Geege, Pax, and the ever-rotating fourth chair every week covering a variety of topics in movies, TV, comic books, fast food, snacks, and more. Nerd Lunch is available from iTunes and nerdlunch.net.
Hi there. So this is John Cross from the After Movie Diner. How are you doing today?
Okay. How are you doing?
I'm very good, sir. I'm very good. Thank you very much for agreeing to an interview. That's very kind of you. Thank you.
My pleasure.
We had just covered recently the Maniac Cop trilogy. In fact, I was very lucky to speak to Robert Davi briefly the other day about it, and just wanted to get a few words with yourself. So what first got you into directing, and what were your influences?
Well, my influences were really The films of the late 60s, American films and films from Europe, the Sergio Leone films. Some of the American films were like The Wild Bunch, French Connection, Bonnie and Clyde Bullitt. You know, there was all those films from that golden period of the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
And yeah, those were really my influences.
Okay. And so what were your steps into getting into directing? And was it always directing you wanted to do, or?
Yeah, I wanted to make movies. I wanted to direct films. I didn't probably know exactly what it entailed. All I knew was the director had a certain imprint on the films that I liked. And so I was very aware of a director's, you know, what a director was doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was it. I wanted to direct movies.
Great. And yourself and Larry Cohen, James Lickenhaus, Frank Henenlotter and stuff were all making movies in New York before it was all cleaned up. And there was a lot of social commentary in your films like Vigilante, Maniac Cop series and Maniac and so on about that. And you also managed to film on those streets and capture it really well. It seems like filming here now would be sort of nicer and safer, but the movie's less atmospheric and gritty or exciting. What do you feel about New York now it's been cleaned up? And what was it like back then in the 80s and 90s being part of those great New York filmmakers?
Well, I got to tell you, it was I really am nostalgic for the period when Times Square was this movie mecca where you had, you know, a dozen cinemas all on one block showing such a diverse group of films. You had one theater showing Fellini art films next, you know, two doors down from a porno theater.
Yeah.
And I just loved it because it was like a smorgasbord for a film buff. It was, you know, who had an insatiable appetite, you know, to want to watch every movie ever made.
Yeah, right. Do you think there was ever a point where they could have kept the theaters but cleaned up the streets? Or was it just a case of we got to get rid of it all, do you think?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, the driving force behind the cleanup was Disney. Right. When Giuliani did the lease with Disney, I think, for the Amsterdam Theater. And, you know, it sort of blossomed from there. I got to tell you, when I go through Times Square now, I hate it. I absolutely hate it.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I've lived here for 5 years, and if I can avoid it, I do like the plague. I can't bear it, just for the number of people, if nothing else. But, you know, I watch those films from everything from sort of Taxi Driver and then, you know, what Larry Cohen was doing with the blaxploitation movies in the 70s all the way through to, you know, the 80s and 90s movies. And while you wouldn't necessarily want to live there because of the kind of element that was on the street, the films are so much richer, better, more exciting and more interesting for it, for some reason, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, there was an atmosphere, there was a feel. Now, I must tell you also that until about a year and a half ago, I lived in the East Village.
Yeah.
And of all the neighborhoods that cosmetically did not really change very much, the East Village is one of them. So you could still I could still walk down the streets in the East Village, and some of that's changing. I have to admit, you know, there was a Starbucks that opened and all that, but it still reminds me of the streets of my youth over there.
So if you were to make another movie in New York, you'd film it down there?
Yeah, I would probably gravitate towards the East Village, Lower East Side.
Right.
Those places, as I said, you know, cosmetically, they still ring of that period.
Okay,
but
cool.
You know, sadly, the ma and pa places of my past are disappearing. They're kind of coming. You know, they can't survive in Manhattan anymore. They're moving to Brooklyn.
Yeah. And were you conscious? I mean, obviously, Maniac Cop is made with James Lickenhaus produced it and Larry Cohen wrote it. Were you conscious of sort of a filmmaking group that was happening in the 80s, or were you all just doing your own thing and happened to converge on Maniac Cop?
I mean, we all kind of knew each other. Jim financed Maniac Cop. He didn't really have a creative participation in the film itself, or, you know, he kind of agreed to put up the money, and then I showed him the movie, you know, 8-9 months later.
Right.
Larry wrote the script. I knew Larry for several years, And we happened to have a fateful lunch where the idea of Maniac Cop was born. And then we started shooting it a month later.
Very cool, very cool. The Maniac Cop trilogy is a great mix of different genres. There's obviously action and horror and even comedy. Does that come from you or Larry, or is that both of you working together? And what draws you to kind of do cross-genre pieces like that?
Well, it's Larry's script inspired it. And I, of course, love... I'm a big film noir fan.
Yeah.
And so I kind of viewed the Maniac Cop films... is a kind of a film noir where you have this cop who had been wronged and framed and thrown into prison, and now he's taking revenge. You have Bruce Campbell as the unfaithful husband who somehow is believed to be the maniac cop and must do his own detective work in order to vindicate himself. So there's all these noir elements. You know, you have Sherry North, who's a classic, you know, tragic noir figure. Remember her?
Oh, yeah, completely.
The crippled older cop.
She's in love with him, isn't she? Yeah.
In love with him. So you have all of these classic noir characters in a kind of a wacky horror tale.
Yeah. No, I just wondered how much of it was sort of, especially the humor, I guess, in it, how much of that was sort of conscious and how much of that you were sort of putting in because you like that element as well? Or?
Well, yeah. I mean, I always think anywhere I can inject humor in a picture, I try to do it.
Yeah.
And so I never shy away from humor. I look for it any way I can, whether it's verbal or visual humor. I'm always looking for that because at the end of the day, the Maniac Cop films were intended to be a fun ride. And humor is really, it's the different side of the same coin that is of horror.
Yeah. And was it always, were you the one pushing for sort of each sequel to get more and more action-packed? I mean, you know, the second one and the third one both end with the main character on fire doing more and more ludicrous action things. You know?
I must tell you, I've disowned the third one. Even though I was involved, it was a film that was it became a kind of a committee movie.
Right.
The script that Larry originally wrote wasn't what actually wound up in the film.
Right.
And there were various reasons. I don't know if you were sent the Blu-ray, but we're about to release the Blu-rays of Maniac Cop 2 and 3. Right. And the Maniac Cop 3 Blu-ray contains a behind the scenes that discusses the Cop 3 and why I and Larry disown it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I had a question about that because I'd sort of seen some trivia online, but no real depth. And I hadn't received the Blu-rays yet. But yeah, no, I was interested what happened with that. I mean, I understood that there might have been a conflict with the producer or something, but I didn't know that you and Larry had both disowned it.
It really wasn't a producer conflict. It really, what happened was, we were in pre-production on the movie. Larry had written a script that had a beginning, middle, and end. It was interesting. I don't think it was as good as Maniac Cop 2, but it was an adequate script. And suddenly the financiers, within a couple of weeks of shooting, said to us they couldn't close a deal for Japan, which had been a big territory for Maniac Cop 1 and 2, because the lead was to be a black actor. It was going to be a black detective.
Right.
It wasn't going to be McKinney continuing or Robert Davi continuing. And so to make a long story short, in order to close this important piece of the financing and to get the movie moving forward, I had to agree to bring back Robert Davi. The only problem is we were within a couple of weeks of shooting. We had already chosen all the locations. And we now had to fit a square peg in a round hole. And the domino effect, I didn't realize was going to be as big as it became.
Right.
And so it inevitably caused tension among everybody because we were operating without having a solid script. You know, what script had really started to become obsolete.
Is that when you put in sort of funny scenes like the Paul Gleason, Robert Forster scene to kind of... Or was that just always in the script? Or?
That was in the script. The scenes that were added to kind of pad the movie were the romantic scenes between Robert and the doctor.
Right. Okay. I see. Yeah.
They were kind of put in there. Some of those I didn't even shoot. And there was like one kill of throwing a guy over a car or something, which I wasn't involved with.
Right. Okay.
But the problem is that when we went into production and we started to trim the scenes that were specific to the character of the black detective, we wound up going into production with like a 70-page script.
Right.
Needing a 90-minute movie.
Right, exactly.
And what was there in the 70 pages was, you know, we started to see things unravel.
Yeah.
It was a film that I believe was ultimately... what we should have done for Maniac Cop 3 is, in retrospect, we should have stopped pre-production, accepted whatever the losses were of money that had already been spent, and gone in and rewritten the script from beginning, to the end.
Yeah.
And then gone back into pre-production.
Yeah.
We should have suspended. And I think we were all, if we were all honest with ourselves, we were kind of greedy to want to just kind of collect our money and move on to our next projects.
Yeah. Although I suppose by the time you get to a third part, it's maybe the passion for whatever the original idea was is not always going to be there in the same way.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I don't disagree. I think I was feeling a little dispassionate about it.
Yeah.
I really just kind of wanted to move on, and I did feel a little stuck in the mud. But all of that, of course, was entirely different for part two.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about part two as well.
Part two was just the highlight of my life in my career, because it was an enormous challenge, but it was also very satisfying.
And so that's your favorite of the trilogy and almost the favorite of your films, it sounds like.
It is. It's actually my favorite film. I was so happy to rescue it from oblivion. It was stuck in a bankruptcy and had been out on budget DVDs looking like shit.
Yeah.
And on, Netflix and, really a transfer that had been done back in like 1990. And so I've gone back and retransferred the movie from its original negative and fully restored it, both the video and the sound. And in fact, we're doing a re-release of the film around the country over the month of November and December.
Oh, excellent. When are the Blu-rays set to come out?
November 19th. The Blu-rays, it's a Blu-ray-DVD combo pack that's coming out on November 19th. For people that are in New York, we're going to be screening Cop 2 at midnight on November 15th and 16th at the Sunshine Cinema on Houston Street in Manhattan.
Yeah, I go there a lot. I'll definitely be there for that then.
Oh, great. Great. Maybe you can help me with the Q&A afterwards.
Sure, that would be fantastic. Yeah, if you'd like someone there to moderate it or whatever, that would be great.
Couldn't hurt.
Yeah, well, I mean, by all means, I can give you my details at the end of this. And
okay.
Yeah, no problem at all. I'd be happy. That'd be fantastic. That'd be a dream come true for me. That would be great.
After Movie Diner. That works out great. We can call it the After Movie Diner Q&A.
Great. Well, that'd be fantastic. Well, thanks so much for that. I just wanted to ask, there was one of the questions about part two, actually. I wasn't able to find all the information, but was there a reason Bruce Campbell didn't continue on in Maniac Cop 2, or was it so that you could, like with Tom Atkins in the first, scare the audience by kind of killing him off early and meaning that anyone could die during the movie?
It was multi-purpose. It was psycho-esque that, we can shake the picture up.
Yeah.
By killing off somebody you perceive is going to be around by the end of the picture. But it also allowed us to freshen the movies, because you kind of take a character and you kind of wring the character dry of everything you want to know about the character, and then you want to kind of move on to some fresh character with a fresh perspective.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes it fun, because you kind of bring in new people with new ideas and new new characters, it freshens it up. So, we kind of took Tom as far as we could, We took Bruce and Lorene as far as we could. And I really thought by the end of Cop 2, we took Robert Davi as far as we could.
Yeah. No, the main thing that's interesting about the three films is the cast. You know, I mean, also the change in genres, but the cast throughout all three are fantastic. And you've got, obviously, you've got like some of the bigger names like Tom Atkins, Bruce Campbell, Davi, and Paul Gleason and people, but also your regulars, people you've worked with a lot, Leo Rossi, Robert Forster, Frank, is it Pesky or Pesci?
Pesh, sorry.
And
or we call him Pest.
Pest, okay. Well, in Maniac Cop 3, he kind of becomes a pest, doesn't he? He's running around with his camera crew and things. and then obviously Lou Bernacki, who you've worked with. Well, a lot of those guys you've worked with, again, Relentless, they're all in, and some other films.
Well, it's fun, you know, when you become a family. It's kind of fun to, like, you know, have Lou Bernacki come in and, you know, and he's so good.
Yeah.
I love really good character actors. He kind of made that supporting cop role his own.
Yeah, definitely. And you've got also a thing where, like you were saying about, you know, you went as far as you could with each of the characters. The first two, the way they sort of drop characters and pick up new ones, it's almost like a stream of consciousness. There's almost that idea of, instead of trying to stick to some script guideline, well, in 90 minutes, your hero's got to do A, B, and C over the course of three acts. You know, Larry Cohen just says, well, no, Tom Atkins, at this point, he's done what he can do. He dies, then we go off with Bruce, and then Bruce dies at the beginning of the second one, and so on. It's a really interesting way to work.
Well, the fun of genre is that, you know, the audience already knows when they bought their ticket what to expect.
Yeah.
And it's to surprise them. That
definitely
always is the challenge when you're doing genre. And that's always been Larry's gift as a writer, is he is so well versed in genre that he knows how to kind of take it and turn it on its head.
Definitely. Yeah. I love his films and your films as well. Just the way he writes and the way you get stuff on screen is just fantastic. I'm a big, big fan of that. Like I said, New York filmmaking from that period. And so with number two being your favorite, what are some of fondest memories that you have from shooting the film then?
Well, the fondest memories is getting through it, because we were working in such difficult cold. I mean, it was bone chilling cold when we were shooting the New York exteriors on Cop 2.
Yeah.
I can remember looking at a clock on a bank on the first day of shooting, and it was like 3 a.m. We're doing the shot where Lorene and Claudia Christian exit an apartment building and get into a taxi. And I look over, and it's like 2, 3 a.m, and the temperature is like 22 degrees.
Oh,
and
wow.
My bare fingers are sticking to the metal on the camera.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's...
It was that cold. And because we were seeking New York vistas, we were always shooting in proximity to the rivers.
Right.
The opening title sequence, which was shot in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, that could not have been any colder. Because we were right on the water. We were right against the water.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, it's like, I guess it's like the Army, you know? You hate it while you're there, but when you get through it, you kind of look back fondly of it because you really pushed yourself.
Yeah, and that's obviously reflected then in the quality of the film. You know, it's one of the great sequels in terms of like those genre and horror picks. It's one of those great sequels up there with something like Evil Dead 2, of course, which in some people's minds improves on the first one. You know,
well, that was my other thing is I was determined to the best of my ability, improve on the first film.
Yeah.
That was my goal. I wanted it. I, you know, not only did I want to repeat, but I wanted to repeat better.
Yeah.
Bigger and better.
And I think that's always the best thing about the genre films is they tend to go for that. And they, you know, when they succeed, it's a joy. You know, it's really great. So just a couple more questions about other films, if that's okay.
Sure.
Vigilante is a big favorite of mine. We had a great time covering it on a much earlier episode of the show, I think about a year and a half ago now. Are there any great stories about working on that film?
Was I involved with that with that discussion?
No, we didn't. We didn't have you on back then.
You guys just did it yourselves?
Yeah, I have got sort of in the second and going into the third year of doing the show, reaching out for things like interviews and things like that have become more of a priority now. Rather than back then, we were just doing a kind of review show.
Well, I should tell your audience that, you know, the Nighthawk Cinema in Brooklyn?
Yes, I do, yeah.
They have a series that, called The Deuce.
Yeah.
And as part of their series, they're showing Vigilante hosted by me, on April 10th of next year.
Oh, fantastic. Excellent. Yeah, well, I'll be there for that then as well.
I'm not sure if it's going to be at Nighthawk or it's going to be on 42nd Street. I'm not really sure how they do it.
Right.
I think they do it at Nighthawk itself. But in any event, there it's going to be April 10th. Vigilante is part of the Deuce series with the Nighthawk Cinema.
Oh, that's great. It's such a good film. And obviously, Forster and Williamson are fantastic in it. What was it like? Because it was very early in your career, obviously. What was it like working, you know, with these two guys who were so established from sort of the 70s grindhouse movie scene?
Fred Williamson and Robert Forster are today of my dearest friends, particularly Bob. I see him more frequently than Fred.
Yeah.
And during the making of the picture, which was made again in very difficult situations on the bone-chilling streets of New York, it was these guys never were complainers. They were consummate pros. They contributed enormously to the movie, and I just can't say enough great things about them. You know, they're just two, in my mind, two giants.
Yeah. And when you were putting the films together, were you thinking of them specifically, or were you thinking of people like them from those genre picks of the 70s?
The one thing I recall when I was working on the script for Vigilante is I wrote next to a character that Woody Strode played.
Yeah.
I put in parentheses Woody Strode.
Great.
So I would say the only character in Vigilante where I had a very strong preconception of who it should be, because he just had a certain aura about him, was Woody Strode. Robert Forster, the character that Robert Forster played, was actually cast. We had another actor cast for that role.
Yeah.
Who shall remain nameless. He was I've become friendly with him now, but back then we parted ways.
Right.
And Fred, I would say, you know, when somebody suggested Fred, I just jumped on it and I could think of no one else.
Yeah, he's just a fantastic presence on camera.
It just popped in my head, the actor that we wrote the role that Fred Williamson played, who we had in mind when we were doing the script, was Leon Isaac Kennedy.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
That's who we had in mind. But when Fred's name was mentioned, you know, it was like, yeah, of course, let's get Fred.
Of course, yeah. And again, obviously, he had worked with Larry back in the 70s, so there was that connection there as well, I guess.
Yeah. In fact, I met Larry through Fred.
Oh, that's how it worked. I wondered whether you and Larry knew each other and he'd given you Fred, or whether it worked the other way around. Okay, that's interesting.
No, cool. It didn't work the other way around, but it was a situation where we were already shooting the movie and Fred met Larry and I came along, and that's how I met Larry the first time.
Oh, very cool. And I'm currently watching Relentless at the moment, the film you did in L.A. with Judd Nelson, Leo Rossi again, and Robert Loggia. How did that film come about? What are your memories of directing that out in L.A.?
Well, that film was a very easy film to make. It was all shot in L.A. It didn't involve any extensive action or stunt work. It was mostly a character piece. And it was Leo is a great guy. Robert Loggia is a great guy. And Judd Nelson is a great guy. So, you know, it was just, you know, we had a good script. The script had been written by Phil Alden Robinson.
Yeah.
But he used a pseudonym, because it was before he became famous.
Oh, okay.
So he used a nom de plume, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
And but he wrote the script, and it was a very good script. And, you know, Bob Loggia and Leo worked, you know, they got along great. And, you know, it was one of those films that was very easy to make. It was, you know, it was like taking a vacation. It was, I would say, stress-free.
Oh,
as filmmaking goes.
Yeah. It was a joy, actually, having just watched the Maniac Cop trilogy back-to-back, not for the first time, but for the show, and then going on to Relentless and seeing in that opening scene with Leo Rossi in the police station all those familiar faces being back in the film again.
Yeah.
Looking down the cast list and seeing all your regulars pop up. I love directors who have those, that, like you say, family around them of actors. It's always good fun.
It's fun. It's you know, it's a fun thing, you know. They're good. You're not going to... Look, you're not going to keep people around who are bad.
Right, exactly.
You know? So you're working with really good people, and you have some fun.
Well, that's great, man. That's great. I'm really enjoying the film anyway. I can't wait to finish it. And then lastly, just... intrigued because I also do a second show with a friend of mine. It's kind of a comedy show about 80s and 90s action films. And one of the ones we came across was Jeff Speakman's film, The Expert.
Now, oh, God.
Yeah. You're.
Oh, God.
We have one of those things about Jeff Speakman films. I'm not quite sure why. But what can you tell us about that? Because it's saying you're uncredited on IMDb, but.
Yeah, I got to tell you. I mean, I don't know how. Is there a level above asshole that you can call somebody?
Oh, you mean a level beneath asshole?
Beneath,
I guess.
Asshole,
like,
I should
worse
say.
Than asshole.
I'm trying to think of.
Well, there is, but I mean, it's a four-letter word. It's probably offensive to most people.
I would say so.
Yeah.
He was just. He really was. You know, it was, you know, I mean, what do you say? The guy has got no talent. Yes, he knows martial arts, but he just is really a guy with no real talent or soul or, you know, a heartbeat. You know, he's just flat.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard to make a movie like that.
And were you involved... Were you meant to be involved for the whole film and left, or were you brought on when something else didn't work out? Or
no, it was a situation where I started the picture, and in some ways it was very similar to Maniac Cop 3. It got to a point where, you know, it was just we in that case we were really limited because of the star of the film.
Right.
So things had to be cut. It was things that, you know, it just was difficult.
Yeah. Okay.
And so then, I don't know why, but in both cases, Maniac Cop 3 and this, in order to fill out the running time, there was a need to shoot these prolonged romantic scenes with Jeff Speakman and the lead actress. I forget her name now.
Right.
And she was a dark-haired woman.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, man, this is just unbearable. It's unbearable. So, you know, Jeff had a guy who he liked who was the stunt coordinator. And I said, you know, guys, just finish the movie. You know,
yeah.
I don't have any interest in it. I let this guy who shot about a week take the credit for the film.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want it.
No, I was just interested. I didn't want to bring up anything that was too negative or anything. I was just interested.
It's not painful. It's just, you know, look, if you're going to have positive experiences in the film business, you're certainly going to have negatives.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, I've had many more positive than negative experiences.
Well, that's great. And I saw, because you must have been the one who put Ted Raimi in it then, because doesn't Ted Raimi have a tiny cameo as
he
the photocopier guy?
Yeah. Is he a mafia guy?
No, he's a photocopier guy. He's working on the...
Photocopier guy, right.
Right.
Yeah, I did his scenes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, Ted, yeah.
You know, I had to put him. Again, family.
Of course. Yeah, because obviously you're close with the Raimis there in both the Maniac Cop. And was Sam meant to be in Maniac Cop 2, or was that...
Yes, he was. And we cut his scene because it just kind of distracted from the flow.
Right.
But on the Blu-ray and DVD, the new Blu-ray and DVD, I have put his deleted scene on there as an extra.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I can't wait to get those and see the new Blu-rays then. That's going to be
a
real treat.
You know, email me your info and I'll get them out to you.
Oh, that would be great, Bill. Thanks so much for that. That would be fantastic. Was it those experiences then that moved you on to Blu-ray and DVD releasing and producing, or was it just time for you to...
You know what? While I was making movies in the 90s, now, you got to put your time... You got to get back in your time machine, but there was a format called Laserdisc.
Yes.
That was all the craze with film buffs. And I began acquiring movies and retransferring them, adding extras and putting them out on Laserdisc. Well, then towards the end of the 90s, suddenly there was this new format, DVD, which was Laserdisc-like. It was sort of I consider it a relative of Laserdisc.
Yeah.
And I started putting the things on DVD that I had previously put on Laserdisc. And suddenly the business began to boom. So it really wasn't that my directing career propelled me into becoming a video company owner. It just, it just sort of happened.
Right, okay.
You know, serendipity rules in this business.
Yeah, definitely. And it was great that you were able to just kind of go with that. I mean, you had 20 successful years as a director, and now... Is it now like 20 years now as a successful releaser and producer of movies? And
I would say 15.
15, okay. And were you with, was I right in thinking you were with Anchor Bay originally before Falling
Well,
Beyond
actually,
again?
I never worked for Anchor Bay.
Oh, okay.
But what I did is I produced their early DVDs. I produced the Anchor Bay DVDs through 2002.
Right. I was just curious because there was a lot of obviously Raimi and Campbell related stuff
right.
that was released through them, and I wondered if that was down to yourself. But
it was,
yeah.
And then the European films and.
Well, that's fantastic, man. That's fantastic. Well, look, thanks ever so much for your time this afternoon. It's been really great.
It's my pleasure. We're also, since you're nationwide, I mean, there are other screenings in other cities before New York. Like, we're showing it at the New Art next Friday, the 8th. It's being shown at the New Art Cinema in Los Angeles. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I've been there once. I went there to see My Name is Bruce when Bruce Campbell was out there with
okay.
it.
Okay.
But yeah, if you want to send me the list of the release dates and the cities, I'll put them up on the website with the episode, yeah?
Oh, that would be great.
Keep in touch if you want me there on the 15th, 16th.
Yeah, the 15th.
Yeah, let me know.
Send me all your details.
I will do, Bill. Thanks ever so much, man. Very kind of you, and I'm a big fan of your work. We'll continue to trumpet it as long as I have the show and the website and everything.
Thanks, John.
All right, man. Well, look, thanks for talking today, and you have a good afternoon.
Same to you, pal. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi there, I'm Agumbo, and I'm with the Traumatic Cinematic Show. We're a podcast that talks about films. Yeah, we'd like to invite you to come listen to our show. You can find us at traumaticcinematic.com. You can also find us on Twitter at DC Podcast Crew. Also, you should come over and check out our Podomatic page, traumaticcinematic.podomatic.com. We're also on Facebook, so you can come on out there and find us too.
I'm on the internet.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that great interview there with Bill Lustig. It was a great time talking to him about his films and his career. Just to run down then about the screenings of Maniac Cop 2 that are taking place across the country. Just wanted to run them down here. They will also be available on the website. But it starts off as soon as November 6th. You can go to the Alamo Drafthouse Main Street in Kansas City, Missouri. November 8th, Alamo Drafthouse Slaughter Lane in Austin, Texas. November 8th, at midnight, the Landmark New Art Theater in Los Angeles, California, with a Q&A with director William Lustig and special guests to be announced. November 8th and 9th, midnight, at the Music Box Theater in Chicago, Illinois. November 15th and 16th, midnight, at the Landmark's Sunshine Theater in New York City, New York, with a Q&A again with director William Lustig, which he mentioned in the interview. May even include myself as well. November 15th and 16th, Hollywood Theatre in Portland, Oregon. November 16th, the Mayfair Theatre in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. November 20th, Alamo Drafthouse Westlakes in San Antonio, Texas. November 22nd and 23rd at midnight, the Coolidge Corner Theater in Boston, Massachusetts. Again, with a Q&A with director William Lustig on the Friday night only. November 23rd, the Alamo Drafthouse Lakeline in Austin, Texas. November 23rd, Alamo Drafthouse Vintage Park in Houston, Texas. And November 29th, Alamo Drafthouse Littleton in Littleton, Colorado. November 30th, the Alamo Drafthouse Loudoun in Ashburn, Virginia. And January 18th at the Capitol Theater in Cleveland, Ohio. I do urge you, as it is a new 2013 DCP restoration of Maniac Cop 2 that Blue Underground are presenting, I do urge anyone who is in any of those cities to go check the film out. I know when they remastered Zombie, for example, Lucio Fulci's Zombie, and screened it at the Landmark, it looked absolutely fantastic. So I can only imagine what Maniac Cop 2 is going to look like. It's going to be brilliant. So, I urge you all to go check them out. The links to getting tickets and things like that will be on our website over at amdpodcast.blogspot.com or aftermoviediner.com. And, yeah, it should be a great night if you go down and check one of those screenings out. Thank you ever so much again for listening to this special part two episode, to our 100th episode. Hope you've enjoyed it, and you can check us out next week and every week on the podcast from the After Movie Diner, the weekly show featuring discussions on new, classic, and cult movies and movie icons. No film subject is off limits, and no opinion is wrong. Check, please. Like the show? Well, you can find our complete podcast archive over at amdpodcast.blogspot.com or aftermoviediner.com. You can send us an email at aftermoviediner@gmail.com, tweet us at aftermoviediner, or follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/aftermoviediner. Or why not be a part of the show and leave us a voicemail over at speakpipe.com/aftermoviediner. You can also support the show a number of ways, by spreading the word to family, friends and co-workers, by writing us a review over at iTunes or TalkShoe, by purchasing some excellent diner merchandise over at cafepress.com/aftermoviediner, by donating on our website, by advertising with our website, or maybe you're a regular Amazon user. If so, then before you make a purchase, go to amdpodcast.blogspot.com, aftermoviediner.blogspot.com, or aftermoviediner.com and click through the Amazon banner ads. It costs you nothing extra, but they throw us a few coins for the trouble. Or, like the movies we cover, then buy them over at our personal Amazon store, also on amdpodcast.blogspot.com. Really, thanks everybody for everything you continue to do, and please keep listening.
There are men, and then there are second unit podcast men. The podcast you've just been listening to is part of the Second Unit Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at 2upn.blogspot.com or on Facebook under the Second Unit Podcast Network. Our fantastic list of shows include Drunk on VHS, We Came from the Basement, No Budget Nightmares, The After Movie Diner, Dr. Action and the Kick-Ass Kid, and Bloodbaths and Boomsticks. Take one podcast into the shower. Don't be a blithering idiot, Alan. We can give you the multiple podcast cleansing system all in one place and your hair deserves. Our programming is available across all platforms, from iTunes to Podomatic, TalkShoe to Stitcher, so you have absolutely no excuse. Listen today and a free naked person of your choice will be shipped from Thailand to your door in a matter of weeks. The Second Unit Podcast Network, bringing you the action and leaving the boring stuff to the other guys. Bloody hell, who does a girl have to blow around here to get a decent beverage?